Well, it's just past 10:45, so we'll start. I'm sitting here because of the microphone right there, otherwise I might wander around a little bit more. My name is David Wee. I'm an English professor from St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, where I teach classes on Victorian literature and writing and short stories and baseball. And every other year I bring a group of St. Olaf students up here to Holden for the January term, and we spend a month here reading short stories and talking about how fiction works, and I'm able to use a lot of the stories that I really like and like to come back to over and over again. And I'm going to read, and then we'll discuss a story from one of the textbooks that I've used in one of those classes. One reason I chose to do some short stories here, and particularly the stories I've picked for this week, stories about mothers and daughters, is because most of my teaching is with 18 and 20-year-old people. St. Olaf is almost entirely peopled by students of that age. So I never am able to talk about stories like this one with people who are mothers and parents. And I've discovered in the few times I've talked with people who are older than 20 about certain stories, the responses are strikingly different. And that's why I'm especially interested in the stories I picked this week. A few days ago, we listened to and then discussed Tilly Olson's story, I Stand Here Ironing, which is one of my favorites. And several people this week have told me it's one of their favorite stories, too, about a poor mother raising a daughter in difficult circumstances and her trying to cope with that sense that so many of us have as parents of, did I do the right thing? Did I do the wrong thing? Is my child going to turn out all right? Is it my fault? Is it somebody else's fault? And that story, in a very effective way, discusses that. This story for today is called Everyday Use by Alice Walker. Alice Walker is a black writer. She's the author of The Color Purple, which was published 10 years ago. And some of you may have read that remarkable novel or seen the movie and know something of Alice Walker and her life and interests. This isn't a Christmas story. Here we are celebrating Christmas, but it's a story about mother and child, and it's appropriate for Christmas. And I think that you'll find it interesting to notice how this mother handles a difficult situation between two daughters. This is really a cross-cultural story. The mother who narrates this story, so you'll have to imagine that I'm this 250-pound black woman, because it's her language and her thoughts that are being narrated for us. She is faced with a real cultural conflict within her own family and the difference between her two daughters, and a real problem, a decision that comes up for her, and the way in which she resolves it is interesting, and I think will give us a chance to do some good discussion about parenting, about resolving these conflicts between children who differ, daughters who differ from each other. One thing that I should explain is that there are some references and a couple of names in here that sound very strange, because what we learn is that the older daughter, who's going to return home during the course of the story with a boyfriend, has become a black Muslim. And yet the story is set in rural Georgia, so she has gone off to the big city just as Alice Walker did. She went off to college. And has become a black Muslim and has changed her name, you know, like Cassius Clay changed his name to Muhammad Ali, and therefore there are some difficult to pronounce names in here, but I thought it might help you to know where those come from. The story is just 6 pages long, so sit back and relax and enjoy it, but pay attention because we want to talk about some of the details in the story that give us clues about the issues that are at stake here. I will wait for her in the yard that Maggie and I made so clean and wavy yesterday afternoon. A yard like this is more comfortable than most people know. It is not just a yard. It is like an extended living room. When the hard clay is swept clean as a floor, and the fine sand around the edges lined with tiny irregular grooves, anyone can come and sit and look up into the elm tree and wait for the breezes that never come inside the house. Maggie will be nervous until after her sister goes. She will stand hopelessly in corners, homely and ashamed of the burn scars down her arms and legs, eyeing her sister with a mixture of envy and awe. She thinks her sister has held life always in the palm of one hand, that no is a word the world never learned to say to her. You've no doubt seen those TV shows where the child who has made it is confronted as a surprise by her own mother and father, tottering in weakly from backstage. A pleasant surprise, of course. Why, what would they do if parent and child came on the show only to curse out and insult each other? On TV, mother and child embrace and smile into each other's faces. Sometimes the mother and father weep. The child wraps them in her arms and leans across the table to tell how she would not have made it without their help. I have seen these programs. Sometimes I dream a dream in which Dee and I are suddenly brought together on a TV program of this sort. Out of a dark and soft-seated limousine, I am ushered into a bright room filled with many people. There I meet a smiling, gray, sporty man like Johnny Carson, who shakes my hand and tells me what a fine girl I have. Then we are on the stage, and Dee is embracing me with tears in her eyes. She pins on my dress a large orchid, even though she has told me once that she thinks orchids are tacky flowers. In real life, I am a large, big-boned woman with rough, man-working hands. In the winter, I wear flannel nightgowns to bed and overalls during the day. I can kill and clean a hog as mercilessly as a man. My fat keeps me hot in zero weather. I can work all day breaking ice to get water for washing. I can eat pork liver cooked over the open fire minutes after it comes steaming from the hog. One winter, I knocked a bull calf straight in the brain between the eyes with a sledgehammer and had the meat hung up to chill before nightfall. But of course, all this does not show on television. I am the way my daughter would want me to be, 100 pounds lighter, my skin like an uncooked barley pancake. My hair glistens in the hot, bright lights. Johnny Carson has much to do to keep up with my quick and witty tongue. This was her dream that she mentions. But that is a mistake. I know even before I wake up. Who ever knew a Johnson with a quick tongue? Who can even imagine me looking a strange white man in the eye? It seems to me I have talked to them always with 1 foot raised in flight, with my head turned in whichever way is farthest from them. Dee, though, she would always look anyone in the eye. Hesitation was no part of her nature. How do I look, Mama? Maggie says, showing just enough of her thin body, enveloped in pink skirt and red blouse, for me to know she's there, almost hidden by the door. Come out into the yard, I say. Have you ever seen a lame animal, perhaps a dog run over by some careless person rich enough to own a car, sidle up to someone who is ignorant enough to be kind to him? That is the way my Maggie walks. She has been like this, chin on chest, eyes on ground, feet in shuffle, ever since the fire that burned the other house to the ground. Dee is lighter than Maggie, with nicer hair and a fuller figure. She's a woman now, though sometimes I forget. How long ago was it that the other house burned? 10, 12 years? Sometimes I can still hear the flames and feel Maggie's arm sticking to me, her hair smoking and her dress falling off her in little black papery flakes. Her eyes seem stretched open, blazed open by the flames reflected in them. And Dee. I see her standing off under the sweet gum tree she used to dig gum out of, a look of concentration on her face, as she watched the last dingy gray board of the house fall in toward the red hot brick chimney. Why don't you do a dance around the ashes, I'd wanted to ask her. She had hated the house that much. I used to think she hated Maggie, too. But that was before we raised the money, the church and me, to send her to Augusta to school. She used to read to us without pity, forcing words, lies, other folks' habits, whole lives upon us, sitting trapped and ignorant underneath her voice. She washed us in a river of make-believe, burned us with a lot of knowledge we didn't necessarily need to know, pressed us to her with the serious way she read, to shove us away at just the moment, like dimwits, we seemed about to understand. Dee wanted nice things. A yellow organdy dress to wear to her graduation from high school. Black pumps to match a green suit she'd made from an old suit somebody gave me. She was determined to stare down disaster, any disaster, in her efforts. Her eyelids would not flicker for minutes at a time. Often I fought off the temptation to shake her. At 16, she had a style of her own and knew what style was. I never had an education myself. After second grade, the school was closed down. Don't ask me why. In 1927, colored asked fewer questions than they do now. Sometimes Maggie reads to me. She stumbles along good-naturedly, but can't see well. She knows she is not bright. Like good looks and money, quickness passed her by. She will marry John Thomas, who has mossy teeth and an earnest face, and then I'll be free to sit here and I guess just sing church songs to myself. Although I never was a good singer, never could carry a tune, I was always better at a man's job. I used to love to milk till I was hoofed in the side in 49. Cows are soothing and slow and don't bother you unless you try to milk them the wrong way. I have deliberately turned my back on the house. It is three rooms, just like the one that burned, except the roof is tin. They don't make shingle roofs anymore. There are no real windows, just some holes cut in the sides, like the portholes in a ship, but not round and not square, with rawhide holding the shutters up on the outside. This house is in a pasture too, like the other one. No doubt when Dee sees it, she will want to tear it down. She wrote to me once that no matter where we choose to live, she will manage to come see us. But she will never bring her friends. Maggie and I thought about this, and Maggie asked me, Mama, when did Dee ever have any friends? She had a few. Furtive boys in pink shirts hanging about on wash day after school. Nervous girls who never laughed. Impressed with her, they worshipped the well-turned phrase, the cute shape, the scalding humor that erupted like bubbles in lye. She read to them. When she was courting Jimmy T, she didn't have much time to pay to us, but turned all her fault-finding power on him. He flew to marry a cheap gal from a family of ignorant, flashy people. She hardly had time to recompose herself. When she comes, I will meet... But there they are. Maggie attempts to make a dash for the house in her shuffling way, but I stay her with my hand. Come back here, I say. and she stops and tries to dig a well in the sand with her toe. It is hard to see them clearly through the strong sun, but even the first glimpse of leg out of the car tells me it is Dee. Her feet were always neat-looking, as if God himself had shaped them with a certain style. From the other side of the car comes a short, stocky man. Hair is all over his head, a foot long, and hanging from his chin like a kinky mule tail. I hear Maggie suck in her breath. Is what it sounds like. Like when you see the wiggling end of a snake just in front of your foot on the road. D next. A dress down to the ground in this hot weather. A dress so loud it hurts my eyes. There are yellows and oranges enough to throw back the light of the sun. I feel my whole face warming from the heat waves it throws out. Earrings, too, gold and hanging down to her shoulders. Bracelets dangling and making noises when she moves her arm up to shake the folds of the dress out of her armpits. The dress is loose and flows, and as she walks closer, I like it. I hear Maggie go, again. It is her sister's hair. It stands straight up like the wool on a sheep. It is black as night, and around the edges are two long pigtails that rope about like small lizards disappearing behind her ears. Wasuzo Tino, she says, coming on in that gliding way the dress makes her move. The short, stocky fellow with the hair to his navel is all grinning, and he follows up with, Assalamu alaikum, my mother and sister. He moves to hug Maggie, but she falls back right up against the back of my chair. I feel her trembling there, and when I look up, I see the perspiration falling off her chin. Don't get up, says Dee. Since I am stout, it takes something of a push. You can see me trying to move a second or two before I make it. She turns, showing white heels through her sandals, and goes back to the car. Out she peeks next for the Polaroid. She stoops down quickly and lines up picture after picture of me sitting there in front of the house with Maggie cowering behind me. She never takes a shot without making sure the house is included. When a cow comes nibbling around the edge of the yard, she snaps it and me and Maggie and the house. Then she puts the Polaroid in the back seat of the car and comes up and kisses me on the forehead. Meanwhile, Assalamu alaikum is going through the motions with Maggie's hand. Maggie's hand is as limp as a fish and probably as cold despite the sweat, and she keeps trying to pull it back. It looks like Assalamu alaikum wants to shake hands but wants to do it fancy. Or maybe he don't know how people shake hands. Anyhow, he soon gives up on Maggie. Well, I say, D. No, Mama, she says, not D. Wangoro Liwanaka Kimanjo. What happened to D, I wanted to know. She's dead, Wangoro said. I couldn't bear it any longer being named after the people who oppress me. You know as well as me you was named after your Aunt Dicey, I said. Dicey is my sister. She named D. We called her Big D after D was born. But who was she named after? Asked Wangoro. I guess after Grandma D, I said. And who was she named after? Asked Wangoro. Her mother, I said. And saw Wangoro was getting tired. That's about as far back as I can trace it, I said. Though in fact, I probably could have carried it back beyond the Civil War through the branches. Well, said Assalamu alaikum, there you are. I heard Maggie say. There I was not, I said, before Dicey cropped up in our family, so why should I try to trace it that far back? He just stood there grinning, looking down at me like somebody inspecting a Model A car. Every once in a while, he and Wangoro sent eye signals over my head. How do you pronounce this name, I asked. You don't have to call me by it if you don't want to, said Wangoro. Why shouldn't I asked. If that's what you want us to call you, we'll call you. I know it might sound awkward at first, said Wangoro. I'll get used to it, I said. Ream it out again. Well, soon we got the name out of the way. Asal Malakim had a name twice as long and three times as hard. After I tripped over it two or three times, as I've been doing, he told me, just call him Hakim, a barber. I wanted to ask him, was he a barber? But I didn't really think he was, so I didn't ask. You must belong to those beef cattle peoples down the road, I said. They said, Asalam Alaikum, when they met you too, but they didn't shake hands, always too busy feeding the cattle, fixing the fences, putting up salt lake shelters, throwing down hay. When the white folks poisoned some of the herd, the men stayed up all night with rifles in their hands. I walked a mile and a half just to see the sight. Hakim, a barber, said, I accept some of their doctrines, but farming and raising cattle is not my style. They didn't tell me, and I didn't ask, whether Wanger O.D. had really gone and married him. We sat down to eat, and right away he said he didn't eat collards, and pork was unclean. Wanger, though, went on through the chitlins and cornbread, the greens and everything else. She talked a blue streak over the sweet potatoes. Everything delighted her, even the fact that we still used the benches her daddy made for the table when we couldn't afford to buy chairs. Oh, Mama, she cried, then turned to Hakim, a barber. I never knew how lovely these benches are. You can feel the rump prints, she said, running her hands underneath her and along the bench. Then she gave a sigh and her hand closed over Grandma Dee's butter dish. That's it, she said. I knew there was something I wanted to ask you if I could have. She jumped up from the table and went over in the corner where the churn stood, the milk in its clabber by now. She looked at the churn and looked at it. This churn top is what I need, she said. Didn't Uncle Buddy whittle it out of a tree you all used to have? Yes, I said. Uh-huh, she said happily, and I want the dasher too. Uncle Buddy whittled that too, asked the barber. D, Wangaro, looked up at me. Aunt D's first husband whittled the dash, said Maggie, so low you almost couldn't hear her. His name was Henry, but they called him Stash. Maggie's brain is like an elephant's, Wangaro said, laughing. I can use the churn top as a centerpiece for the alcove table, she said, sliding a plate over the churn, and I'll think of something artistic to do with the dasher. When she finished wrapping the dasher, the handle stuck out. I took it for a moment in my hands. You didn't even have to look close to see where hands pushing the dasher up and down to make butter had left a kind of sink in the wood. In fact, there were a lot of small sinks. You could see where thumbs and fingers had sunk into the wood. It was beautiful, light yellow wood from a tree that grew in the yard where Big D and Stash had lived. After dinner, Dee, Wangaro, went to the trunk at the foot of my bed and started rifling through it. Maggie hung back in the kitchen over the dishpan. Out came Wangaro with two quilts. They had been pieced by Grandma Dee, and then Big Dee and me had hung them on the quilt frames on the front porch and quilted them. One was in the Lone Star pattern. The other was Walk Around the Mountain. In both of them were scraps of dresses Grandma Dee had worn 50 and more years ago, bits and pieces of Grandpa Gerald's paisley shirts, and one teeny faded blue piece about the size of a penny matchbox that was from great-grandpa Ezra's uniform that he wore in the Civil War. Mama, Wangaro said, sweet as a bird, can I have these old quilts? I heard something fall in the kitchen. And a minute later, the kitchen door slammed. Why don't you take one or two of the others, I asked. These old things was just done by me and Big D from some tops your grandma pieced before she died. No, said Wangaro, I don't want those. They are stitched around the borders by machine. That's made them last better, I said. That's not the point, said Wangaro. These are all pieces of dresses grandma used to wear. She did all this stitching by hand. Imagine! She held the quilts securely in her arm, stroking them. Some of the pieces, like those lavender ones, come from old clothes her mother handed down to her, I said, moving up to touch the quilt. D, Wangaro, moved back just enough so that I couldn't reach the quilt. They already belonged to her. Imagine, she breathed again, clutching them closely to her bosom. The truth is, I said, I promised to give them quilts to Maggie for when she marries John Thomas. She gasped like a bee had stung her. Maggie can't appreciate these quilts, she said. She'd probably be backward enough to put them to everyday use. I reckon she would, I said. God knows I've been saving them for long enough with nobody using them. I hope she will. I didn't want to bring up how I had offered Dee Wangaro a quilt when she went away to college. Then she had told me they were old-fashioned, out of style. But they're priceless, she was saying now, furiously, for she has a temper. Maggie would put them on the bed, and in 5 years they'd be in rags, less than that. She can always make some more, I said. Maggie knows how to quilt. Dee Wangaro looked at me with hatred. You just will not understand. The point is these quilts. Well, I said, stumped, what would you do with them? Hang them, she said, as if that was the only thing you could do with quilts. Maggie by now was standing in the door. I could almost hear the sound her feet made as they scraped over each other. She can have them, Mama, she said, like somebody used to never winning anything or having anything reserved for her. I can remember Grandma Dee without the quilts. I looked at her hard. She had filled her bottom lip with checkerberry snuff, and it gave her face a kind of dopey hangdog look. It was Grandma Dee and Big Dee who taught her how to quilt herself. She stood there with her scarred hands hidden in the folds of her skirt. She looked at her sister with something like fear, but she wasn't mad at her. This was Maggie's portion. This was the way she knew God to work. When I looked at her like that, something hit me in the top of my head and ran down to the soles of my feet. Just like when I'm in church, and the Spirit of God touches me and I get happy and shout. I did something I never had done before. Hugged Maggie to me, then dragged her on into the room, snatched the quilts out of Miss Wangaro's hands, and dumped them into Maggie's lap. Maggie just sat there on my bed with her mouth open. Take one or two of the others, I said to Dee. But she turned without a word and went out to Hakeem, a barber. You just don't understand, she said, as Maggie and I came out to the car. What don't I understand, I wanted to know. Your heritage, she said. And then she turned to Maggie, kissed her, and said, You ought to try to make something of yourself, too, Maggie. It's really a new day for us. But from the way you and Mama still live, you'd never know it. She put on some sunglasses that hid everything above the tip of her nose and her chin. Maggie smiled, maybe at the sunglasses, but a real smile, not scared. After we watched the car dust settle, I asked Maggie to bring me a dip of snuff. And then the two of us just sat there, just enjoying, until it was time to go into the house and go to bed. Well, again, as with many modern short stories, you know, there's not a whole lot of action, you know, not a lot of major excitement, no car chases, no blazing guns or anything. Kind of a quiet, really a domestic story. How did it make you feel? How do you respond to this dilemma, to this woman telling the story of this visit?
I don't know if I could have been as patient with the intruder.
Yeah.
I think that patience of hearing her out, it was so gentle.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, most of us, you know, after we've put a few years between our college experience and older adult life, we get embarrassed remembering how we were when we came back home to tell our parents everything we knew. And here's Dee coming back, you know, not only thinking she's smarter than her mother, but she's got culture. She's got the right culture.
I thought it was interesting that the statement that the world never knew how to say no to her. And she knew that. I mean, she didn't ask for, she had that better term.
Yeah.
Offer. She just says, I want it.
Yeah, that's right.
And I thought it was interesting because that's the first time maybe the world said no to her before.
Yeah, that's right. She's not used to this. And she's angry. You know, she just stomps out of here. Have others of you had family experiences where one child is, you know, seems to have everything going right, and the other one is always living in the shadow of that one? Or has this been your own case with your own siblings, and that there's a conflict constantly between the one who always has yes said and the other one where it's always no?
I think I've been experiencing this retroactive, not in my family, but in my husband's family. Mm-hmm. And dealing with his children who didn't know the story of their father and my husband. And I realized in talking to them that my husband was the one who was able to do things and do them well and got them done, and their father was always trying to catch up.
Yeah.
And this still carries on because even though my husband is not living, his brother talks about him as if he's this wonderful saint, and I keep thinking, golly, what, you know, wake up, take care and be yourself.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be just women that happens to.
Sure, yeah, that's right.
It was kind of like an aha to me when I thought, no wonder he's like he is. He's never really realized his own potential because he was always laboring under this other person who was totally different, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And he's never learned that it's okay.
And that's what we've got here with this Maggie and Dee. Dee is the older, ambitious, forceful, successful kind of a person just through a course of her personality. And Maggie is the shy, retired one.
Well, a lot of it is personality. I'm thinking about my own family. I'm the oldest, but it's my younger sister who comes on strong and is always, I felt like she was the big sister, telling you what to do and all this kind of stuff. It wasn't that she was more successful or that kind of thing, but it's just this personality.
Now what we have here is a mother trying to figure out what to do at a juncture she hasn't anticipated. Mm-hmm. Suddenly there's a decision she's got to make.
But didn't she see it grow for a long time? That's when you have to step in.
But when you're living with it, you don't always see it. I think sometimes.
Yeah. We were given a couple of clues about the fact that she knows about this conflict, especially with the older daughter. How does Alice Walker do that for us? What, do you remember anything from earlier in the story that sets up this?
The reading, when she read it to them.
Okay. The daughter Dee came home from college and just sort of forced ideas and reading on the dumb mother, and, you know, dimwit is the word that the mother used, the sister and mother, and has this condescending attitude.
Well, even when the house was burned, that she said to her daughter, why don't you go and dance around these ashes?
Yeah.
He didn't say what we were.
Yeah. Did any of you think about how the fire started?
I wondered.
Yeah.
She said it, didn't she?
Only indirectly. Oh, that she set the fire. Yeah, I think Dee set the house on fire. And we don't learn that directly, but here's the, when the mother is trying to recall how long ago was it that this fire happened, 10 or 12 years ago, and describes how she can still feel Maggie, you know, who ran into her arms aflame. And she has these permanent scars. I mean, part of Maggie's problem is that she has been permanently scarred from this fire. And the mother says, "And Dee, I see her standing off under the sweet gum tree. She used to dig gum out of a look of concentration on her face as she watched the last dingy gray board of the house fall in. Why don't you do a dance around the ashes?" I'd wanted to ask her if she had hated the house that much.
You'd think she'd be more concerned about the family instead of concentration. You would think she'd be just, you know, really worried instead of concentrating.
Yeah, well, she's feeling guilt. You know, I think she set the fire and has scarred her sister for life because of it. Now, I think the mother knows that. I think the way this is phrased, the mother has apparently never accused Dee of this. But when she says, "Why don't you just go dance around that house that you hated so much?" This only comes out, you know, subtly in the story. But here Dee not only has forced her strength of personality on the rest of the family, but she hated her upbringing. She hated the very house. It's about heritage, isn't it? So she apparently has set the fire, and the mother knows this, and knows what it's done to Maggie, and how it has really caused Maggie to be so shy and backward, because she's, you know, self-conscious about her scars. And yet here's a mother still needing to love both her daughters.
Not being a very assertive person, I was trying to think what I would have done about those quilts. I probably would have given them each one, see? But I'm proud of her that she did it the way she did it. I admire her because I might not have been able to do it.
I
saw some change in Dee, however, because then later on when she was coming to visit now, she said, well, she did say that no matter where we chose to live or what house, she would come to visit us. So she didn't cut them off completely.
But I see Dad is coming to visit them as a curiosity in the way that she was taking all these Polaroid pictures. And it's as if, and a curious kind of choice that she's making now as to what she wants to retain from her past.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think that the relationship between the mother and the two girls is a perfect metaphor for the sort of history issues and the class struggles and the race issues. And I think it's funny and ironic that Dee is so interested in her heritage and her history, because she's a perfect metaphor for white oppression and white domination. Perfect.
Yeah.
But is she really interested in the heritage, or does she want something for show?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's not her heritage, it's for show. It's in.
She just wants
it. It's in.
Everything.
It's, well, it's an in thing. You know, it's the type of thing she took with an in thing. And she just wants them to hang on her walls and say, this is family. But it's not the heritage, it's for the show.
Yeah.
They're art objects. The quilts are art objects rather than put on
that's right. It's all
and
art
use,
and for show, for when people come
right.
to see.
She wants to show what she has escaped from, really, doesn't she?
Yes. Yeah.
She escaped from her humble house the first time by burning it down.
I can see that thing blown up in a great big picture and on her wall. And
yeah,
uh-huh.
That's right. You know, she's now got the kind of clothing and the culture and is moving in circles that she thinks are important. And the way her family heritage functions is to say, see what I've come from, and now I'm this. These things are artifacts, are works of art,
right,
to hang on the wall.
The name thing is also controlled.
Yeah. She wants to disassociate herself with her very name. And she makes a serious mistake here, doesn't she? And part of the humor here is when she explains why she has dropped the name Dee. Because she thinks she's named after the white oppressors, that this is a white person's name. And what the mother explains is that she's named after her mother and her grandmother and her great-grandmother, and It's her black heritage after whom she's named.
Something puzzled me, and I can't quite explain it. The only time she noticed her little sister really, or showed any affection at all, was after the quilts had been taken away from her, and just before she left.
Yeah.
I wondered if that was because she wanted to preserve in her mind that she had left with her thinking well of her, or why she did that.
Yeah, what good question. What do you think about Dee's final parting comment to Maggie? Yeah, make something of yourself. It's a new age for us, she says, for black people.
But in view of her personality, as she'd shown it, she would have thought she would have been angry at that point.
Yeah. But remember that Maggie said, Dee can have the quilts. Yeah. I can remember Grandma Dee without the quilts.
It's really humbling to the other person, if you really reflect on
that. Yeah. So, yeah, but Dee is too full of herself to sense that. You know, she goes away unchanged, doesn't she, from this experience?
I don't see it as much as a complimentary kind of parting. I think it's almost an insult to say that to her, because I think of Maggie as the person who knows herself and, you know, heritage and what's important to her a lot more than Dee does. Dee is just grasping at straws.
Yeah.
Trying to figure something out. And so she wants Maggie to be more like her, basically, is what she's saying. You know, go make something of yourself like me.
Yeah.
A little daughter kind of thing. And I don't see it as happening at all.
But I think it was sincere. I don't think she knew what she was saying. I think she really was saying to her as kind of a nugget of input of knowledge and because that Maggie really didn't understand this is what Maggie should do. And I don't think she was saying that to be mean. I think she really meant it, mm-hmm. You know, because she couldn't see any use for that kind of life. Or
I think there's elements of sincerity. And I have an older sister who's very, I moved up to Canada with my parents as a kid, and my older sister just waited our whole stay to get back to the United States, went to university right away. And so me and my little sister have grown up in Canada, and it's not quite like being black in the deep south, but when my older sister comes back, she's not quite as offensive as Dee was, but still in my sister, there's always that sense of, well, you didn't go to America like me, but I really wish that I was had grown up in Canada like the two of you. And so I think that Dee, that you can't say she's being sincere, but you can't say she's being insincere either, because what she'd like is both worlds. She'd like to be loved by her sister and like to be loved by her mother, like everyone would, and would like to have black heritage, but she took off. So her way of feeling this black heritage is through this identification with the African way back,
yeah.
And that isn't black American heritage. And so I think that a comment like that holds a little bit of sincerity, but also holds a little bit of insult so that she can still protect herself and still feel good about what
she's doing. She felt some ignorance also, just she doesn't have any idea of what Maggie's life is like. No idea whatsoever. She's gone off and doesn't even, I don't know, it's like a token gesture, if anything.
You know, and what's really sad about Dee is that Dee knows she burned the house down and that she's the cause of Maggie's scars and Maggie's sort of backward personality, her shyness. And what has Dee done about that? You know, nothing. She's going through life taking care of herself. And it's hard to like Dee because of what we know just about that fire.
I don't like her at all. She comes home and wants to take the best that they have and take it away.
Yeah.
She doesn't care about them.
But often the most assertive, I think, are the most scared. And I just, you get a real sense from Dee in this story. It's just being scared out of her mind. You know, here's her mother and her sister, the supposed weak people in the story. But they're, like you said, grasping at straws. They live their lives and they're happy. I mean, the mother seemed pretty happy.
What's Dee afraid of?
afraid.
I don't see her afraid of anything.
I think she's afraid of who she is, you know, afraid of not ever being able to understand, which I think could possibly be a problem with Black Americans. I'm not a Black American, so I don't know. But just that longing for identity, and I think Dee longs for identity within her family, identity within her race, and identity within America.
Just from the fact of how much she's changed, like when she went to college, she wouldn't take the quilt. Now she's come back and changed her mind and is trying to find something to identify with, and it seems to be all sort of material things rather than anything that comes from within her. So in a way, I mean, I think she recognizes that in the sense of, I guess I got the same sort of sense, maybe not fear so much as a lack of identity.
She's not a likable person, granted, but a person that feels sorry for, I think. And I felt sorry for her through the whole story.
I don't know at all.
That's interesting, because I would say.
I mean, that type of person makes you angry. But even though there are a lot of type of people like that, I don't think it's natural. I don't think it's a human way to be.
Why did she come back and want the best that they had left? She wanted the handwork that these grandparents had made. She wanted the best quilts. That's what was the only thing they had.
Maybe because that's the only possible way she can feel connection with her family, because she doesn't have any other way from within herself to feel connected, so she has to find something, some way of showing herself that she is connected, even if she isn't. I think it's really pitiable to feel that way. And I think that's what she's doing. I don't know if she feels bad about it, but as an outside observer, I look at her life and I say, well, there's not a whole lot there besides this brash personality that needs something more and is trying to get it but doesn't know how, doesn't have the background to get it, and so now has to start in the now, in the present, to make something of her past, which was non-existent.
Looking sort of for tokens of her heritage, but that really have no real meaning for her
personally. Yeah. Even the butter churn, it's being put to everyday use.
It doesn't work without the top.
That's
she's
right.
Destroying the churn by taking it for
some
measure. Yeah. And Mama, sees the handprints that have been.
Yeah. That's right.
By her destruction.
Yeah.
Mama should have gotten the idea before she got the butter churn, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But you know, I agree, pitiable is a great word, and pitiable people are not likable people all the time. And Dee's not a likable person, but I just have this overwhelming sense of, I mean, you understand your heritage by living your heritage. Well, whether she gets the quilts or the churn or whatever, Dee's never going to understand her heritage.
But think of the other sister. She stuck herself behind curtains, was afraid to be seen. She lived that kind of a life.
But her other sister wasn't afraid to say, go ahead and take the quilts. I understand my heritage. I remember Grandma, whether I had the quilts or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a victory for her.
And even shut the name. I mean, that to me, one of the things we're learning about is the importance of names and the connections that names have. And this, hers was a generational name, and to said that's only a white
Yes. Yeah, what was her name? Wango?
Wango.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It has no connection with
to her. Someone who spent generation after generation in the deep south.
That's
I mean, that has nothing to do with the Black American experience
yeah.
at all.
Yeah, that's right. This must have been a kind of family difficulty that existed in many of our families a couple of generations back, you know, when and being assimilated into American culture became very important for people, and began to, you know, abandon the language of the old country and the habits
and to redo the names, to spell them differently,
yeah.
at least, if not to change them completely, to fit in.
Yeah.
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 Or to name your children American names rather than
Yeah,
names
that's right.
Change.
Yeah.
What's happening today with the
norms,
just exactly the kind
sure.
of thing.
But we still put Norwegian things up in our house and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I've never been to Norway. You know.
Yeah.
But I think that's coming, you know, that's another generation down the line.
Third and fourth, maybe, rather than second, first.
Children of the age that would be my grandchildren now are getting names like Hans. Mm-hmm. And, old names are, it kind of skips a generation and then it's brought back.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if Dee wasn't also living out some of her guilt, if she had caused this fire which destroyed everything that was in that first house. I don't know how she was living out that guilt, but to try to now acknowledge it was okay. Now I do want some of,
Yeah, that's
she has
that
a struggle within
be.
Herself, mm-hmm. I think. Now, realizing that she had destroyed a lot of things, now maybe she wants to be sure she shows some kind of acceptance of them.
Well, she's scraping for identity through the whole story. Yeah. Just, who the heck am I? Through the whole story. When Maggie and her mother are completely aware of who they are.
You think they're satisfied with themselves?
Maggie and her mother?
Yes.
Her mother can eat a liver out of a hog 5 minutes after she took it.
Yeah.
She can hang up, she can bash a cow.
How about her other daughter? She's in a corner somewhere. I feel so sorry for that girl. I think the mother should do something to bring out her personality.
But Maggie can remember Grandma Dee without the quilts. That's where you can see Maggie's strength. It's not so much that her present day strength. Maggie's strength is in knowing her past and knowing her groundedness and centeredness within her family and within her Black American heritage, identity. Dee's strength is that she is conscious. She's like reclaiming these symbols in her life, and so she has that strength, but she doesn't. She has to just take the symbols because she doesn't have this. She doesn't remember Grandma Dee.
She doesn't have heritage. Uh-huh. The meek shall inherit the quilts,
I think there's a danger, though, romanticizing that, too. I think we have to recognize the fact that Meg is scarred.
That's right.
But she does have her mother who's supporting her. She has a man who is accepting her. She has skills. That are going to, with the mossy teeth.
Yeah, the mossy teeth.
You can give them a toothbrush. Yeah. but she has the skills that can make quilts, which is background and heritage. So there's a strength that she has that Dee probably is really, it bothers her.
Wait, so what's really
strong people are hard to handle.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I was just going to say, it sounds to me like Maggie has made it. They're just on two different planes, and Dee is blind to her destruction even. I'm not even sure that it sounds like she recognizes the destruction that she's caused, that she's just blinded by her inability to find, maybe it's her identity or her heritage or herself, but that Maggie and her mother know the importance of the important things in life and have found them and are able to live them.
Yeah. And it's the difference between what you call the symbols of the heritage or the artifacts of it and really inside, being at peace with oneself and who I am and not trying to be something other than she is. And both the mother and Maggie, the story ends with the two of them just smiling, sitting there in their, little swept yard, and realizing that they know who they are, and Dee is going off trying to be somebody different. Maybe for profoundly good reasons, but what she's done in the process has been to reject her heritage.
But the mother did something wonderful when she embraced her daughter.
Yeah. That this is what I find most interesting about the story is the mother, because the contrast between the two kids who are, one's leaving the heritage and the other clinging to it is interesting in itself. But when you're caught between that, when you love both these children, and are trying to keep the family together, even though one has just gone off another direction, and where a mother might have, and in this case surely does have cause to be very judgmental toward Dee. And she's even aware that Dee and Hakeem are, you know, passing glances over her head. You know, they're being patronizing toward her, but she's aware of it. She spots this. And she manages to do the right thing. It's an act of grace, really. It's interesting the way she describes it. Do you remember, you know, when she says this moment, she has this little epiphany. She has a sudden revelation of what's the right thing to do. And it's like when she's in church. You know, she said, something hit me in the top of my head and ran down to the soles of my feet. I mean, it's a very visceral thing. Talking about the angel coming and telling us what to do. Just like when I'm in church and the Spirit of God touches me and I get happy and shout. And I mean, here it's clearly grace at work, that she doesn't just sit there and let this happen. She knows what to do and she takes strong action.
Did you get, well, I know when you were reading it too, did you get the feeling that she really probably didn't do that very often with Meg? That she wasn't maybe overly too affectionate and demonstrative, and this was really, for Meg too, a real kind of wonderful.
That's what I thought. One time now here, she loves her.
Yeah. I mean, Maggie has just expressed the exact right thing. She said, she can have the quilts, I can remember Grandma Dee without the quilts. And, I mean, this is, that statement on Maggie's part, is it helps the mother understand that Maggie knows just who she is and appreciates
it. Helps her understand that Maggie doesn't, and in a certain way I'm saying this, Maggie doesn't really care about her, that she just knows that the butter churn works. And that the quilts keep you warm. She's going to use them, and that Dee has a problem with that.
Yeah.
You know, that she's going to use the quilts for what they were made for.
And they'll wear out.
That's heritage.
Yeah.
And if you've got the butter churn on the middle of your dining room table, that's not heritage. That's heresy. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so.
That's right.
So even though Dee makes this claim, I'm the one who understands heritage now, and you guys are mixed up. Maggie understands heritage.
Yeah.
Because she is heritage. She's a continuation of the Black American tradition.
That's right, and that's the major irony of the story. Is when Dee says, you don't understand heritage. And Dee, of course, was the one who doesn't. And Maggie and the mother do. So. It's 11:45. It's too nice a day to stay in here any longer than necessary, but you've had very good insights in the story.
That's a wonderful story.
Yeah, it's a good story.
Thank you.
Yeah.